The debates now mark the final stretch of the 2020 campaigns. And there's two things that I'm hearing a lot from the general public. That's both anecdotally and also in the public sphere. One thing that I'm hearing a lot is that the 2016 polls got it wrong. So for that very reason, we ought not to trust the 2020 polls. And I really want to push back on that perception, because the 2020 polls are really different. For one thing, the 2016 polls did accurately project the popular vote, actually, you know, pretty closely. But it's true that they did not accurately predict what was going to happen in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But here's the thing, even if the 2020 polls turn out to be as flawed as the 2016 polls were in all of those states, Biden is still likely to win in those places. So, for example, in 2016, the polls were about 5 points off, which is a lot, right? They're about 5 points off in regards to what was going to happen in Pennsylvania. But if you subtract 5 points from Biden's current lead in the polls in Pennsylvania, Biden still wins that state. And that's the case in some of the other important states. In Minnesota, he maintains that lead, even if you subtract 8 points, which in 2016, they were off by 8 points. You can subtract all those points and Biden will still, he still looks like he's gonna win. So it's a data illiteracy thing. The 2020 polls have learned from the flaws and the mistakes that happened in 2016. Many pollsters have now figured this out, that they relied too much on national polling averages, didn't look enough at internal state polls. All of that has been accommodated this year.
Waiting for education too, yeah.
Exactly. So that's one thing I like to try to push back on people when they say, it's very popular to say, I don't trust the polls because in 2016 they got it wrong. I don't think that they should be compared so easily there. The other thing, and this goes to the point that I'm anticipating Nate's about to make, there is another popular perception that nothing matters. I understand the sentiment and the affect there, but it's actually not true. So here's the part of it that is true, that Trump's approval ratings have been amazingly consistent over the last 4 years. Amazingly, and I mean historically, right? The last time a president had approval ratings as consistent as Donald Trump was World War II. And he's always in that 40 to 45% range. But there have been moments in the last 4 years where his ratings dipped below that. For instance, after Charlottesville, this is in 2017, it was the last 2 months of 2017, Trump's approval rating was at 37 to 38%. Okay, and there have been other moments where he crept above 45. Now, the difference between 37, 38 and 46, 47 is enormous. And the reason is that we still have 5.5% of voters are undecided. And therefore, these little differences in Trump's approval rating, 1%, 2% are a big deal in terms of what's going to happen in November. I see them as a really big deal. And, you know, the next question really for me is 5.5% of voters are undecided. Where do they live? Do they live in Georgia? Where are they geographically distributed? Because if they're all localized in some of these specific states, it's going to be a big deal. Georgia is exactly tied right now between Trump and Biden. So it's a big deal. The debates are one moment. There'll be other moments leading into November, but 1%, 2% here or there is going to make a really big difference.
That's all fine. You know, you look at the trend lines and you look at the consistency, not just in the president's approval rating, but also in terms of preferences over the summer. We've mentioned this a number of times, but Biden's been at between 7 and 9 points ahead for 4 months at this point. It's just not something that seems likely to change, barring something foundational, like big changes or circumstances that are unprecedented historically. There's all kinds of talk about the process and the procedures and how the election's going to take place. And there's a lot of weird stuff involved. To some of your points, Alex, I think that it's important to look at state polls rather than national polls. And so if you're focused on undecided voters and if you're focused on the gap between the two candidates, I think it's highly important to look at state polls rather than a consolidation in a national poll. And I think that it's, at this point, it's just not very close. And, you know, the undecided voters that you mentioned would have to, in most of the competitive states, they would have to break almost entirely for Trump, which is not likely. There's no historical precedent for that.
What I was saying, I think maybe before we started recording, about the debate being a missed opportunity for the president to try to appeal to some voters outside his base. I mean, I think this is now common sense, conventional wisdom that in order to win in the Electoral College, Donald Trump has to appeal to a different base of voters and a different demographic outside of the voters that are reliably and have been reliably and consistently within his base. And he didn't do that successfully. On the other hand, you might say that his rhetorical strategy of just trying to disorient and scramble is exactly what his preferred genre. It's his White House. It's his way of governing and administering, right? It's an end in itself for him. I mean, we've had four different chiefs of staff in 4 years in the White House. So he pursues continuous upending as a process. And you saw that in the debate. Now, it's hard to imagine any kind of strategic advantage coming out of that. By this point, he's actually made pretty explicit statements that maybe he's not even interested in pursuing an electoral college victory. He's more interested in other kinds of electoral strategies, like nominating and confirming Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. He has said, that's important for me because I need a ninth justice in case the Supreme Court is going to hear litigation regarding ballot tampering, for instance. And he's also talked explicitly and openly and publicly about letting the House vote if the election is very, very close. So those are different kinds of strategies for him for trying to win in 2020. If those are your strategies, then maybe it makes sense to go in and scramble the debate because all you want is noise. Maybe the better chance you have that the Supreme Court and the House decides rather than the people.
I think you're right about the point about the debate. I think that it was a wasted opportunity, but you can say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but disciplined is not one of them. If the hope in the Trump campaign is that they seize some of these opportunities to make their candidate look more reasonable and disciplined and appealing to moderate voters, I don't think that that's likely to happen. I think that we've had plenty of years at this point to know who both of these candidates are, and it doesn't seem like either one of them is going to change a great deal. Here's something else that is kind of bugging me, and this is a little bit of a meta point about the coverage of the first debate. I think that there's an impulse, and I understand why, to be without a viewpoint in terms of like media coverage. And so there's been a lot of narrative about the debate was a mess. But I think that that's kind of disingenuous and a little bit dishonest too. Like there was one part of that debate that was a mess, and it was the sitting president of the United States. And the other two parties, I think, were just kind of struggling to try and keep things under control. I think that there's a lot of things that are unknown still between now and November, but I think that they mostly have to do with how the people in power are going to behave and what they're going to do or not do to make sure that the election actually happens and functions decent way. The only times that the things that you're talking about have occurred, you know, people make a lot of reference to 1867, Hayes versus Tilden, and people make reference to the year 2000, Bush versus Gore. But those were two historical examples where the Electoral College and the popular vote were extremely close. And at this point, and again, for months now, it has seemed that this is not going to be a particularly close race when it comes to the Electoral College or the popular vote.
Well, I'm just thinking of 2000, Bush v. Gore. And in that case, it had to do with hanging chads, and it had to do with difficulties owing to the Florida ballot counting process. In that case, in 2000, Florida was the tipping point state. And in that tipping point state, the count was indeterminable. And that's why the Supreme Court weighed in. So for that to happen again, we would have to really play around generously with Electoral College math, because right now, the most likely state to be the tipping point state is Pennsylvania, I think by far. Is most likely to be the tipping point state, but Biden leads there so commandingly. There was a new poll out that shows him up +9 in Pennsylvania. And as I said earlier, even if those polls are really wrong, Biden still wins that most important tipping point state. So what else is he going to do? If you're not giving up on your base, if you're going all in on your base, which you know worked for him in 2016, so he has some evidence, you know, that that's not a bad strategy for him. But the problem is that he's not running against Hillary Clinton now. He's running against Joe Biden, which is just a completely different candidate with completely different polling numbers. That's the problem.
Yeah. I don't know. This feels extremely weird to say, but I do think that Donald Trump's greatest strength, I think, as a politician, has been his authenticity, his like sort of honesty, and how confident we are and his supporters are that he's really telling us what he thinks, that he's being authentic. That's been, I think, his greatest strength as a personality. And at this point, I think it seems like it's maybe turning into a weakness, because that level of authenticity or that particular appeal, it has a ceiling. And for him to try and like extend the ceiling and extend his support or the people that are open to voting for him, I think he almost has to be a little bit disingenuous. He has to use some spin or politician speak, which not only is I don't think he's very good at, but he also kind of doesn't want to. Like he refuses to. And he, again, he's not disciplined enough to make that seem natural. So I want to mention before we wrap up, though, that there is, for the first time in about a month, there is a new poll out of Alaska voters. This is from a group called Harstad Strategic Research. They polled over 600 likely voters in Alaska, and they polled them both on the question of Biden versus Trump and on the Senate race on Sullivan versus Al Gross. And the results are interesting. Again, you know, normal caveats that you should never put too much stock in a single poll. But in this poll, both of those races are extremely close in the state of Alaska. They have Sullivan up 1 point in the Senate race over Al Gross, and they have Donald Trump up 1 point over Joe Biden in the presidential race. And that's remarkable. I think that we would all agree in a state like Alaska that has at least recently been pretty dark red or bright red, that both the presidential race and the Senate race are potentially that close at this point.
Nate Bauer directs the University of Alaska Press, and Alexander Hirsch is a professor of political science at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm Robert Hannon.